What is happening, gang? We have got something this week and next on the Inside Football Podcast that you guys have been pining for. We're finally going to do it. So this week and next, we're going to do a deep dive into the quarterbacks in the NFL in 2020. And Bill has meticulously gone through all the quarterbacks and divided them into four groups. There's kind of a fifth group that you'll learn about in today's episode, but really four core groups, all the way D, C, B, and A. So in this episode, we're going to look at kind of the bottom half of the league, the D and the C group. Some of the guys who are struggling, some of the guys who are kind of emerging, some of the guys you're on the fence about, and I think some of the placement will surprise you guys. But if you're the longtime listener to the show, you kind of know and expect who's going to be in what group. So this is truly fun to get Bill's unique take on all of these guys. So sit back, relax, and get ready. This is the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian, and this is part one of our two-part look at quarterbacks in the NFL in 2020. Here we go. All right, gang. Well, we are here today with another exciting episode of the Inside Football Podcast with Bill Polian. And much like you've seen us do in the past few weeks, this week we're going to continue our dive into the 2020 season, and we're going to do something that I think everybody's going to really enjoy. In today's episode, we're going to begin the process. It's going to be a two-week process. We're going to dive in this week into quarterbacks in the NFL, and specifically, we're going to look at the bottom two groups of quarterbacks. Bill has done the painstaking work of looking specifically at all the quarterbacks in 2020 and kind of dividing them up into four categories, kind of from the bottom all the way up. So in this week's episode, we're going to get into Group D, which is the bottom, Group C, which is one up from the bottom. And then next week, we'll get into A and B and start looking at some of the elite quarterbacks. But without much further ado, I think it's time to get into it. Rick, why don't you kick us off?
Okay. I did want to say just one thing, though, as sort of a caveat. You know, and that is, Bill, as always, is going to be open, candid, and give you his real opinion. But I want to say that this is about all the quarterbacks. There are no bums who make it to become a starting quarterback in the NFL. They're successful in the NFL to varying degrees. But when you build on, when you rise in that pyramid from tens of thousands of high school quarterbacks to hundreds of college quarterbacks, you know, to at any one time, 32 starters relative to you, you know, you are an extraordinary person. You're an extraordinary athlete. It's just that some people can operate at that level better than others. But I just want to start out. So this is none of this will be by way of disparaging anybody and recognizing, you know, how far they've come. Okay. I just wanted to say that. So. Bill, here you go. Here's the first question. Do you want to talk about Drew Lock? Then I'll ask you the question.
Well, first of all, I want to get to the benchmarks so everybody understands what we're using here as benchmarks in terms of metrics to judge these guys. Ideally, for a winning quarterback in the league, meaning a guy who can get you to the playoffs, you want a QBR of 100 or better. You want a completion percentage of 65% or better. You want a 2-to-1 TD to interception ratio. You want a yards per pass attempt average of 7.5. And after eight games, you'd like to be in the 2,000-yard range. That would be 250 yards a game, which is, you know, the minimum really necessary to succeed. Now, there are, because of different styles of play in the NFL these days, there'll be some anomalies there, but we'll talk about them as we go along. So let's start at the very bottom with Drew Lock, who has a 66.5 QBR, a completion percentage of 55%, 7 TDs, 10 interceptions, so he's on the wrong side of the ratio by a fair amount, and a yards per pass attempt of 6.3. So that is not winning football by any measure, and he is struggling. Now, he does not have a really good offensive line, and he's had some difficulty with the receivers staying healthy as well. But as Vic Fangio said the other day, he's the quarterback. They're going to work through his problems. But I think it's fair to say that this is a pretty high hill to climb.
You know, at what point – when you've drafted a quarterback, you know, do you really know whether you have someone who could really be your starter, maybe be great, or he just can't make it? I'm thinking of people like Troy Aikman and John Elway and Steve Young and Baton, who, you know, did not have great first years, but obviously went on to be Hall of Famers, and other first round draft picks like Jake Locker, Paxton Lynch, and Blaine Gabbert, who were not good in the year one and ultimately never panned out. How much of a sample size do you need to know which way a young rookie is going to go?
At the end of the first year, you want the arrow going up. You want improvement from year's end to from year the beginning of the year to the end. You want them making progress in every category that we've mentioned here, which speaks to accuracy, reading defenses, being able to get the team in and out of the huddle, being able to recognize defenses. And if the arrow is going up at the end of the year, then you feel pretty good about it. If the arrow is not going up at the end of the year and there are no exigent circumstances, then you worry. But it takes 3 years for you to figure out whether or not a guy is actually going to make it.
And if a guy's sort of borderline in that period of time, from the bigger picture of a team, do you ever worry that if the quarterback takes those 3 years to really start delivering, that he could stunt the growth of the other guys around him, like in Denver's case, Hamler and Judy and Fant? Or is that just something that you have to put up with while you're making your determination about the quarterback?
Quarterback's the most important guy. He's the one you're trying to develop. If you choose to stay with him, then everybody else is along for the ride.
Got you.
Jimmy Garoppolo. He's in here only because he's injured, and therefore he's kind of an outlier. And he really should be in group B. But as I say, he's an outlier. So we've simply put him in here because he's only thrown for 735 yards. But that's, as you'll see, the other numbers add up: 101.2 QBR, 63.6 completion percentage, 7 TDs, 2 interceptions, and 7.4 yards per pass attempt. So Jimmy's more than good enough. You can win with him. But the sample size is so small that I just put him in here with an asterisk. Any questions on Jimmy?
Well, I mean, I think the whole thing with the 49ers season has to be an asterisk at this point. I mean, even if he wasn't hurt, with the amount of injuries that they've had, I mean, I think I think that whole team's got to almost have an asterisk. I mean, in a lot of ways, you feel like this Kyle Shanahan's almost doing the Mike Tomlin job of 2020.
Yeah, I agree completely. This team's been decimated by injuries, and everything that could go wrong has gone wrong, and they continue to play competitively. So kudos to Shanahan and his staff and to the players for hanging in there. Our next contestant is a well-known name. And one that the numbers don't add up here. He's probably an example of what Rick is talking about. Daniel Jones from the Giants, 76.1 QBR, 62.4% accuracy rate, completion percentage. Here's the problem: 8 TDs, 7 interceptions, not good enough. And 6.1 yards per pass attempt, which is absolutely not good enough. Why is this taking place? Well, for one thing, early in the season, the offensive line was abysmal, and he was running for his life. Secondly, he does not have Saquon Barkley, which makes and actually the backup that they signed was pretty good. He's down with injury. So he's hamstrung in a lot of ways. He is improving. I can see improvement, although the numbers don't show it. You can see it on tape. And the team is improving. So the bottom line is that they're gonna ride with him. And you hope the arrow is up right now, although sparingly. But you hope in the next 8 games, By the way, they're in the hunt for the division title. You hope that the arrow continues up, and maybe they could make it to the playoffs. So
they look like the division champion right now at this point.
Well, they do, yeah. You know, but that, remember, the NFL isn't 16 one-game seasons, which the media makes it. It is a 16-game season. So at the end, we'll see. But right now, the arrow is slightly up.
Would this be the time he's starting to get more comfortable? I mean, obviously the last 2 weeks, level of competition hasn't been super high. But to your point, the needle definitely feels like it's moving up. Do you think that could be just a function of competition, or is it maybe it's starting to click and maybe he's just starting to feel more comfortable in Jason Garrett's offense?
All of the above. All of the above. So let it play out is the answer. Let's see what happens as we go down the stretch. Our next contestant is Nick Foles, who unfortunately is injured. I hope not badly, but nonetheless, I don't know how much time he's going to miss. His QBR is 83.8. Completion percentage is 65.6. 10 TDs, 7 interceptions, a little high in that area, and 6.1 yards per pass attempt. Which is the reason for that being he doesn't have any receivers. Even Robinson is essentially a possession receiver. So he struggles to drive the ball down the field. He is better than that 83.8. But as we sit here right now, that's where he is. And you can't deny that. And I think that. Unfortunately, I don't know where it goes because of the injury. If you ask me what Nick is, I would say he's a very, very capable backup quarterback in the National Football League who's a marginal starter.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about with him, Bill, because, you know, remember when we did the quarterback show early on and we talked about many things, including the intangibles, you know, one thing about him is every team he's been on, his teammates seem to absolutely love him and want to play for him and rally around him. So what, given the numbers and given what you just said, what's preventing him from becoming, I'm not saying a great quarterback in the NFL, but what's the gap that he can't really become a starter for some team?
Well, don't forget he won a Super Bowl for Philadelphia.
Right.
So let's not forget that.
Right. But he took over. I mean, that's what I'm saying. But the next season, stay the starter of the whole season. That's my point. That he can rally, that he can be very successful, but something has stopped him from, say, being the starting quarterback for a team for 10 years.
Well, the fact that he doesn't have an offensive line and any receivers, and he had neither in Jacksonville. So, you know, that's the reason. Now, you know, can he be a winning starter? We don't know. He has all the intangibles that you mentioned, but we just don't know. And I don't know if we'll find out simply because Chicago's so bereft of offensive talent. So, you know, this is a long road for him to travel. If you asked me as a general manager, what do I see him as? I would say a very, very, very competent backup quarterback. Almost, well, Frank Reich-like.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Jeff Hostetler-ish.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Does it make you so, like, obviously Foles, it would just seem at this stage, is clearly better than Mitchell Trubisky, but seeing how bereft they are of offensive talent and seeing how much he struggled to get that offense going from a GM's perspective, does that make you maybe want to take a second look at Mitchell somewhere else to go, hey, maybe this is a function of, yes, he struggled, but there was very little around him?
Well, this is a Hobson's choice. This is one where you say, no, I don't want to revisit this again, but they may have to. But they're going to have to because Nick is hurt. So we'll find out. But in the end, does Trubisky have what it takes? I can't answer that because I don't have a definitive opinion about it, but I'm skeptical. I was skeptical coming out, and I'm still skeptical because I see a guy that makes plays outside the pocket only and does is not competent inside the pocket, is really not comfortable inside the pocket. Yeah, he can make some plays with his feet. And as Danny Orlovsky said on ESPN a week ago, yes, he gives you more of a chance than to win than Nick does with the Chicago Bears because they don't have an offensive line and they don't have any receivers and they don't have a running back. But in the end, where does that get you?
White knuckling it through the rest of the season.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The next person in this group is Cam Newton. Big name. Not so big numbers. 80.9 QBR. 67.8 completion. Three TDs, seven interceptions. Certainly on the wrong side of that equation. And 7.4 per yards per pass attempt, which is quite good. Cam could always throw the ball down the field. And if he had big receivers who could go up there and get the jump balls that were most times high, you'd get a lot of completions. That's what they did in Carolina with him. New England has turned into a running team, and he's part of that. And that's good. It's certainly a way to win. But the numbers are what they are. And I know that, you know, he's a story and New England's always a story and he can make some amazing plays, but in the end, we'll find out if he's good enough. Because if he is, even with this offense, the style of offense, New England will make the playoffs. If they don't, then we know for ever what Cam really is. But what he is right now is at the top of this last group.
Gladwell-wise, is he a little bit of a statistical outlier? I mean, we kind of alluded to it, but like the numbers you're seeing this year are pretty consistent with the numbers he's had throughout his career, but he's quarterbacked some really successful football teams. Is that just a function of you've developed a system around him, a lot of great players around him? It just seems odd, especially, you know, having been through this a couple times now with you, he sort of seems like an outlier in the sense of the numbers aren't where they need to be, but he tends to be, at least every other year, on teams that are pretty good.
Well, first of all, when you talk about him, when you talk about Lamar, when you talk about Kyler Murray, all of whom are different types of passers, you can't forget the running component of it, which is huge. And I'm not a good enough mathematician to put that component in and create a rating that's better than 80.9. But I can assure you, in answer to your question, that it is better than that. We're going to talk about Lamar and Murray a little bit later on. But the fact is that running component gives them added value. How much added value? We'll see, because Cam now has been injured. He doesn't run quite as well as he used to. You know, all of those kinds of things. He's on the back nine of that added value, whereas Lamar and Murray are on the front nine of it. But that there is a component there. And by the way, no one that I know and trust has developed such a formula. And I want to underline the word trust. The stuff that you hear out there, I'm not going to name names, but the services that give you these statistics that you know, claim to value these players, I do not trust. Let me just underline that and put an exclamation point after it. So, but I will say that their running component gives them added value.
Right.
The next guy that we're going to talk about is also a big name. And unfortunately, not having a great year. And there's no other way to slice that. Carson Wentz, 73.2 QBR, 58.4 completion percentage. That's well below his historical norm. 12 TDs and 12 interceptions. Woo. That's almost off the charts. And 6.2 yards per pass attempt. None of it is good enough. And it's reflected in the Eagles' record. Now, is this entirely his fault? No. The offensive line is aging and not as functional as it used to be. Plus, there's injury there. The receiving core is limited. And his two best receivers and the guys he trusts most, the two tight ends, have been injured. So he's playing with a cast that is less than what he's used to having, and his two biggest security blankets, the two tight ends, his bailout people are not there. So that makes it really hard. But he's trying to do too much. He's playing with clenched teeth, and he's got to take a deep breath and just get back to basics and understand that he's got to don't try to put everything on his back. With this franchise, his back isn't strong enough to do that. No one is. So, is he having a bad year? Absolutely no question. Is he salvageable? I would bet a lot of money on that. He also has had a pretty big turnover with quarterback coaches too, which is also an issue.
It's funny because the question I wanted to ask you was you did a brilliant job of covering it, because I was going to ask you about the regression. Was it attributed to injuries around him, in a skill position, the offensive line, and so on? And then you ended with the other point I was going to ask, which is trying to do too much. I assume, given the kind of person who has been excellent at the NFL level, when these things happen, there must be a natural inclination to press, right? To take people on your back, to try and make things happen because the other elements of your offense can't do it. You want to win games. How do you, without snuffing out what's great in a guy, how do you suppress that as a coach? How do you suppress that desire? You could call it pressing, but you could call it just doing everything you can possibly do to help, and still advance in your career overall.
Well, the way to approach it is to say, don't worry about your career overall, because if you do, then you begin to bring in outside forces. You listen to the noise, which Carson was quoted today as saying he doesn't do, and I'm glad to hear that. I like him a lot as a person, and I want to see him do well. But the thing you do is get back to basics. When Tony Dungy – here's Tony Dungy 101, and it never fails. It never, ever fails. When things go wrong, do less. Period. Full stop. And that's what you have to – sit down and say to him, things are going wrong. We're going to do less with the offense. We're going to ask you to do less. And we're going right back to fundamentals. We're going to work on footwork. We're going to work on reads. We're going to do all the things that made you good in the first place. And we're not worried about the result. We want to be focused on the process.
Yeah, that's exactly, because when I asked about his career, I wasn't talking about from the player's point of view. I was talking about from the team's point of view. But you've captured it that with the Tony philosophy, you can't worry about the future right now. We just have to get through this season, and in this season, less is more. When we recover the other elements, we build a good supporting cast, then we can go back to more being more. But we can't do it now.
Yeah, and the less said about it, the better. The Giants, years ago, when they were a really great team, went through something like a 3 or a 4 game losing streak, and And someone said to Tom Coughlin in a news conference, you know, the morale is down, the offense isn't functioning, the defense isn't playing at a high level, special teams are letting you down. What do you do to correct all these errors? And Tom said, win a damn football game. And I applauded. I was sitting in my office watching the clip, and I applauded. And I called him and left a message and said, you said exactly the right thing. That's just win a football game.
Yep.
Okay, our next contestant is a guy who's getting, again, a lot of press. And I'm not about to tell you that he's a bad quarterback, because he isn't. But he's playing basically like you would expect a rookie quarterback to play when the arrow is up, but it's moving up slowly. Joe Burrow, 65.4%, right on the money. 12 TDs, 5 interceptions, right on the money. 6.7 yards per pass attempt, so that's a little bit low. But he, too, is not the recipient of a lot of great receivers. John Ross has disappeared again. The other two receivers are pretty good. But
T. Higgins has played pretty well.
T. Higgins is playing pretty well, yes. But he also is a rookie. So, this is a rookie who's with a team with a bad defense and a not-so-great offensive line, and the running back position's been nicked up. Mixon has been nicked up. So he's doing about as well as he can, and I would say very definitely that the arrow is up. So he's deserving. It's fair to say the arrow is up. He's the number one pick, so the media follows him all the time, and he's having this great year because he's thrown for 2,400 yards. So what? You actually want him to throw for fewer yards than that and win football games. But that's not a story.
Again, Bill, you anticipated me. So what I was going to ask you about, because clearly this guy has talent, and so maybe I'll just ask you to be a little bit more specific on this. So in watching him through the first 10 games and knowing the arrow is up in terms of the overall evaluation, what about it convinces you that the arrow is up and is going to continue going up versus anything that he's not doing that would give you pause about that?
Well, for one thing, he's throwing too much. He's put in situations where, they're behind all the time and he's got to throw. So you don't like that. And it's just, he's a rookie. He makes rookie mistakes. He'll grow out of it. There's nothing mechanically that we worry about. Is his arm Dan Marino's? No, but we knew that coming in. He's very accurate, very competitive, very poised, very smart. He does what you want him to do. The arrow's up. So, no complaints. I'm not going to put him in the Hall of Fame yet, but as Bill Parcells once said, but no complaints. I mean, he's doing a nice job. Okay, so that's the end of that last group. Before we move on, let me give you just a quick overview on some guys that are outliers for one reason or another. Dak Prescott, as we know, was doing a fine job before he got hurt. 102.6, 68.2, 9 TDs, 3 interceptions, 8.4 yards per pass attempt. Get well quickly, Dak, and make a lot of money. You deserve it. Ryan Fitzpatrick, 95 QBR, 70.1 completion percentage, 7.8 yards per pass attempt, 10 TDs, 7 interceptions. That ratio is why he's on the bench. And that's who he is. That's who he is. He is a very functional quarterback in the NFL. When surrounded with good talent, he can win. Can he take you all the way to the promised land? Probably not. Would you want him as your backup quarterback on a contending team without question. So, I mean, that's what Fitz is. Is he going to throw too many interceptions? You bet. Does he do everything else well? You bet. And then the heartwarming story, the most heartwarming story of all, not that I'm, you know, I don't deal in stories, but this, you can't deny this one. Alex Smith has thrown for only 362 yards because he's just back starting. And his QBR is 70.3, but the completion percentage is 67.3. One TD, three interceptions, 7.4 yards per pass attempt. And he's playing with people who are in the witness protection program other than McLaurin.
Yeah, we're just finding them every week, Bill. That's what we do in this town.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
They're new guys appear from the swamp.
Yes, they're unknown, the unknown soldiers. But the fact that he's back and playing, and Ron Rivera said last week that it's entirely possible that he stays in the job for the rest of the season, it not only is heartwarming, but, you know, appropriate for a guy who's really a solid player. Absent the touchdown to interception ratio, those are his career numbers, and the QBR would be in the, you know, over 100, basically.
Yeah.
Not bad for a guy who's got drop foot.
Amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting that Ryan Fitzpatrick, Alex Smith, Dak Prescott are incredible, incredible teammates. I mean, Nick Foles is in that group too. Their teammates love him. The coaches love him. Everybody in the franchise loves him. And there's a lot to be said for that. And it speaks to their character. And from what we understand, which is, you know, not the most forthcoming information-wise, but everybody in New England says the same thing about Cam. So, you know, good for them. That's what you need in order to succeed in the NFL. So that is the Group D, coupled with the outliers or the asterisks that we need to speak about. And then let me switch from Group before we go to Group C to the teams that are essentially quarterback by committee. The most obvious one is Miami, where Tua has stepped in, and he's got a 104.8 QBR, two games, 659 yards. Wow, that's really something. 63.6 completion percentage, five TDs, zero interceptions, and 6.7 yards per pass attempt. For a raw rookie, those are tremendous numbers. He's blessed by having Chan Gailey there with him, which really helps, particularly when you have a young quarterback who's just learning. Having that gray hair around him, helping him out, is really, really a plus. Carson Wentz doesn't have that at the moment. He did with Frank Reich when Frank was the coordinator. He doesn't have it now. That's part of the problem. But Miami did a tremendous job bringing in Chan Gailey, and the results are showing. And, you know, is Tua going to keep this up? Who knows? We'll find out. Miami is certainly a playoff contender, and there'll be some, you know, there'll be a lot of good battles down the stretch here for spots in the playoffs in the AFC East. But thus far, Tua is as advertised. Let's go to the Redskins. I'm sorry, the football team next. I get fined for that one, that reference.
Yes, you do.
It's totally good. We'll put it in the jar. I got
exactly. it. Exactly. And the money goes to a good charity in the end, so it's fine.
Good. Happy to do it.
Yeah. AKA fans of the Washington football team. It's going directly to this guy.
We've talked about Alex Smith. Kyle Allen was the nominal starter. He has a QBR of 99.4. He'd thrown for 548 yards, 68.8 completion percentage, 4 TDs, 1 interception, and 6.9 YPA. And those numbers were just boggled my mind. I said, wow, that's a lot better than my perception of him. And of course, he was here in Carolina, and I can see why Ron Rivera likes him. Because if he can do that with the cast of characters that are playing with him, he's a pretty solid quarterback. Is he the answer in the long run? I can't say that. But you certainly can say he's a pretty functional NFL quarterback. Let's turn to Jacksonville. Gardner Minshew is 94.9, 1,855 yards, 65.9, 13 TDs, 5 interceptions, 6.9 YPA. He's been benched, and Jake Luton has taken over. He's at 77.0, 60.3 completion percentage, 2 TDs, 2 interceptions, 6.5 YPA. Don't ask me why the change was made. I don't know what Luton is, and we won't know until the end of the season, perhaps. Minshew, in my mind, is like Kyle Allen. If we were having a discussion about who's going to back Peyton Manning up because we want a competent backup quarterback, those two guys would certainly be in the discussion. The last group in this group, if you will, of people that share time is Sam Darnold and Joe Flacco. Joe Flacco is 80.6 QBR, 659 yards, 56.7 completion percentage. Joe is not a high percentage passer, that we know. Four TDs, 2 interceptions, 6.3 YPA. Sam is 70.7, 562, 61.5, not bad. 3 TDs, 4 interceptions, not bad. He too is playing without a lot of talent. And 5.9 YPA, which is not good. So, you know, neither are good enough, and the record, the Jets record shows that. The question is Sam Darnold salvageable? I've been asked that on a number of occasions by a number of people, because it looks as though he may be on the move if the Jets get the first choice in the draft. And my answer is I would want to watch every throw of his career, which has been interrupted by injury, and see ultimately if you can determine what he is. I think the jury is out at this point. He was a very interesting prospect coming out of SC. I thought there was a lot to like about him. People tell me, well, he's kind of low-key, phlegmatic. Well, the guy we're going to talk about in Los Angeles Chargers had the same rep. He's playing a little differently now, to say the least. Right. So I don't put a lot of stock in that.
Yeah.
So, you know, what do we know about Sam? He's talented. Has he delivered yet? No. Are you willing to take a chance on him down the road and at some price if he's available? That's a tough call for a general manager. So those are the guys that are splitting time.
Bill, you weren't in this situation a lot in your career, so this is probably somewhat of a tough question. But, I mean, some of these situations are different. They're all a little different. Obviously, you kind of get what the football team is doing. You have some sense of, you know, some of these other situations where you're splitting time. Obviously, Miami's in a, you know, trying to develop a, you know, future kind of star quarterback. But like when you look at like Jacksonville and the Jets in particular, and it's pretty clear you don't have your legitimate starter on the roster. How does that affect what you're doing in terms of kind of managing the rest of the season? Does it at some level become, you know, about evaluating what you have elsewhere? Do you call the games differently? Is it something that's acknowledged in the building, or is that just sort of a fan myth? And regardless, you know, in New York with Joe Douglas or in Jacksonville, they're approaching these games like they want to win every game, and attacking it that way? Or is there some kind of a shift where it's like, hey, this is a little bit of a lost season. We're not sure what we have at the quarterback position. Let's find out what we have everywhere else.
I would say there's three different levels in the organization. The first level is the coaching staff, and their attitude has to be and should be, we got to try and win every game. And therefore, we have to convince the players that they need to go all out to try and win every game. And we're going to coach all out to try and win every game. Because if we don't, we're going to be looking for jobs. And that's the greatest motivator of all. There are some front offices, some more overtly than others, who say, well, this season's lost. Let's do what we can to try and play as well as we can and try to add as much talent as we can to the team over the course of the season, knowing that we don't have enough in the long run. And the Bears are a team like that. They're trying desperately to try and get better. You know, ultimately, will they get there? It's hard to say, but They're trying really hard to do it. I think the Jets are too, but in situations where they were able to acquire premium choices for players who are marketable, most notably the safety who was holding in anyway, and a pain in the neck, they got good value for him. They made clearly some mistakes. Robbie Anderson was a mistake, letting him go. And that's going to happen. But they're, you know, they're trying hard. They're not overtly getting rid of every player on the team that's worth anything. In Jacksonville's case, that's exactly what they're doing. And this is one of these things that I don't agree with. People do it, and whether it succeeds or doesn't, it remains to be seen. The same individual who did it with the Jets is now with the Jaguars. This is clearing cap space. And what the hell good does that do? I mean, in the end, what are you getting rid of good football players for marginal return because they have big cap numbers? So what? When it's all said and done, have you made your team better? Not really. And it didn't work with the Jets, and it may or may not work here. That's clearly the plan. You know, we'll see over time whether it does or doesn't.
You know, one observation about Flacco and the Jets, because obviously I've followed his career very closely, you know, here in Baltimore. You know, A, great guy, but B, where the Jets are, the way I think Joe Flacco can help you is to build. To me, he always has a puncher's chance, right? Because he can throw the deep ball. He connects, you know, reasonably well with that. So if you're way behind and you got to, you know, just throw your way out and try to score touchdowns through the air, he can do that. But you're right. He's not accurate. You know, he's not a guy who his career, timing was perfect to win the Super Bowl and get the big contract. It was never a great NFL quarterback, was a good NFL quarterback. But, you know, maybe when you're there, the guy who can throw the bomb and hit occasionally might be the best you could hope for. I don't know.
Well, you know, I always took the position and encouraged the people on our staff to take the position that while we know we can only get Peyton Manning through the draft, I want to constantly strive to be the best we can be at every position, including at quarterback. And the important part of playing quarterback, if you don't have the overwhelming talent that a Peyton or a Brady or someone like that has, is to protect the football, is to be able to protect the football, not give the football away, not find a way not to lose. You help your team to win by not losing. So I don't want a swashbuckler as a backup quarterback. I want a guy that's going to be really careful with the football, who's smart, who's going to manage the game, who's going to do all the things that are necessary to help you win the game within the confines of what his ability allows him to do. And so, you know, if you said to me, who do I want? You know, do I want Drew Luck? Do I want Daniel Jones? Do I want Carson Wentz? Do I want Cam Newton? Do I not want Nick Foles? Do I want Joe Burrow? You know, hey, those guys are all starters. So now, you know, among the backups, who do you want? Well, you know, I want the guy who's going to give me the best chance to win, not the guy who's going to do one thing very well and everything else in a way that doesn't help you win. So, you know, I'm probably looking hard at Alex Smith. I'm probably looking hard at Gardner Minshew. I want to know more about Kyle Allen. I may say, you know, I love Fitz in every respect, but the interceptions, you know, yeah. They're hard to live with.
But it's fun to watch his fans.
Well, exactly. That's right. That's exactly right. Okay, having gone through that group, let's turn to the next group, which is, you know, even more interesting. This is the C group, and let's start with Phillip Rivers, 93.6, 68.7 completion percentage, 11 TDs, 7 interceptions, not good, 7.7 yards per attempt. That's pretty good. The receiving core is fair to middling. When Jack Doyle and T.Y. Hilton are there, it's good. It's a winning group. And the interceptions and the sacks in inopportune times are the Achilles heel. That's the thing that causes you to grind your teeth and throw things and get upset. Because he does those things at the wrong times. Mm-hmm. And in lots of cases, it costs you games. The spectacular plays are spectacular. There's no question about that. But, you know, the mistakes are too. So you got to be a little careful with that. Some people would tell you that his reputation is bigger than what he delivers. I would say he's, you know, would you rank him above Roethlisberger, Brady, Manning? No, I would not. But in the next group, he's fine. He's thrown for 2,395 yards. And as we said, you know, 2,000 is the benchmark here. So, you know, well within that, clearly. Any questions about Phillip?
Well, we do, you know, we do have a few fans in Indianapolis. So, Bill, I know you don't like these hypotheticals, but we have had a lot of this on Twitter, so I'll be killed if I don't ask this. Is he playing well enough in 2020 with that defense to get them to a Super Bowl in the AFC?
If he eliminates the mistakes, yes.
Mm-hmm. So, Bill, that brings, you know, sort of begs this question. To me, he's one of those guys, to use your phrase, he just has the interception gene. Is that something, especially at this point in somebody's career, you can possibly overcome?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he can. You know, he's just got to discipline himself. He's a veteran enough player. He's just got to discipline himself to say, as Tony Dungy once said, they asked him, how can you help Peyton Manning? He said, I can teach him that it's okay to punt. And that's what Philip has to learn. He's got a great defense. You know, rely on it. Let them help you win. And you do the rest. There's no question about the coaching. The move they made the other night to bring Jacoby Brissett in after having failed to score, I believe, 21 points because they couldn't knock it in from the three-yard line running the ball. They don't have a back who can bang it in there. So with the game about to turn, their fourth trip to the goal line without scoring a touchdown, they inserted Jacoby Brissett in the game and let him run it in there. Great coaching move. A perfect example of why Frank Reich and his staff are great coaches. They let the defense take it over from there, and they ran away and hit. So, you know, there's no question about the coaching. And am I biased? Sure I am. But I got evidence
right.
to be biased, to be biased with. So, yeah, he is good enough as long as he eliminates the mistakes. He took a sack in 2 minutes, which you know, he can't do. He's got to throw it away. Did the same thing the previous week. Can't do that. You got to throw it away. The next person we're going to talk about is Lamar Jackson. Very, very interesting. Let's talk about the numbers. 95.6 QBR, 64% completion percentage, 14 TDs, 5 interceptions. Great. 7.1 yards per attempt. That's darn good. But here's the thing. 1,762 yards passing, which should be well above 2,000, excuse me, given those other numbers. Why is it below 2,000? Considerably below, because they run the ball. This is a different offense. The Patriots, the Ravens, to a lesser extent, Arizona, and Minnesota essentially are running offenses. And so Lamar is a huge component of that. And so, as I said with Cam, he brings value added with respect to his ability to run, how he affects the defense. We've talked about those things ad nauseum. But he's exceedingly functional. And the only question about him is when you're behind against really good defenses who know how to defense him and defense that system, and you have to come from behind and throw from the pocket, can he win doing that? The answer is, thus far, three outings such as that, no wins. That's a story. I'm not hanging my hat on that. I think they're capable of it, and you know, we'll find out as time goes by. He's gotten better as a passer than when he came in the league, and he's probably he and Murray are the most dynamic guys in the game with the ball in their hands. So there's a lot to be said for that. The reason the yardage is down is simply because this is a running offense, not a passing offense. It's an old-fashioned, old-school offense, which wins, by the way. I'm not criticizing it in the least.
So why I don't have a magic number, and you said nobody does, if you look at his combined rushing and passing yards last season, that was 4,356. His run game is down a little bit, but where he is at that passing number is well ahead of where he was last year. So he's actually on track to come out with more total yards. But Bill, having watched them closely, it seems to me that for the most part, there are certain throws where Lamar is just fantastic. When he's throwing across the middle to tight ends, when he's throwing in a lane directly in front of him, when he has a clear opportunity, if he's throwing in the flat, he hasn't yet showed me that he could, you know, throw the ball downfield and drop it in the bucket. But what worries me more than that is I feel like when the Ravens are really playing well and they are exactly doing what you're saying and they're emphasizing that ground game, but the ground game that's most successful for them is when Lamar is not just scrambling around and then turning nothing into something. It's the games when they do call his number as a designated runner a lot. And that's when they're most successful. But, you know, all the running quarterbacks and the careers that have been cut short, like RG3's, from injury, when you're taking those blows out in the open, make me very, concerned for the long-term future, for him and for the Ravens with him as the quarterback. If in the end that's his true, they truly need him to really be a runner to help that offense fully effectuate.
Well, I, you know, that's a little bit of an old school point of view. I'll give you the new school point of view, both from two general managers that I really respect, both of which do not work for Baltimore. And of course, as everyone knows, I respect Ozzie and his group immensely, and John Harbaugh as well. And from two coaches that I respect greatly, all of whom said, we are long past the time where anybody worries about longevity at the quarterback position. The idea that you're going to draft Peyton Manning and he's going to be there for 15 years is long gone. We're now talking about coaches and general managers basically having 3 years to win. And if they can win with a quarterback who can, in Cam Newton's case, played reasonably well. He got them to one Super Bowl. Played reasonably well over an 8-year career or a 7-year career. I've kept my job for 7 years. That's all that counts. We're long past the time when we're talking about, well, I want this guy for 15 years. You know, win football games. That's all that counts, because ultimately we all need to stay employed. And so if Lamar has a 6 or 7 year career because of injury, unfortunately RG3 had a very short, even shorter career, or any of these other running quarterbacks have less than long careers, we'll discuss that at Hall of Fame time. Right now, it's not a discussion.
Bill, do you think that some of that's the unintended, maybe not unintended, but some of that has to do with the new rookie system where, you know, you basically have him for 4, you have the 5th-year option on the first-round picks, that system being instituted has kind of even further put an emphasis on winning now?
Well, I'm not so sure I see a direct correlation. For one thing, you actually have him for 7 years if he's a first-round pick, because you got him for 5, and then you can tag him for 2, right?
Right, yeah.
So you got him for 7. And that's probably almost any quarterback's shelf life except for an elite guy. So that's point one. Point two, playing with a rookie quarterback certainly helps you cap-wise because he's played well below market rate. But, you know, what do you do with the rest of that money? If you're Baltimore, you do a great job of adding the Calais Campbells of the world and the Ngakwe's of the world and that kind of thing. If you're an average run-of-the-mill team, you don't add anybody. And that's any good. So it all comes down to the ability to judge personnel, not the ability to manipulate the cap. That's a bunch of malarkey. And every once in a while it filters up, you know, but in the end, there's no proof of that. But an exceptional player like Lamar or like Kyler Murray can come in and make a dent right away if you have the right offense for him and be able to help you win. Russ has developed over time and is getting paid and should, of course, and is phenomenal. Excuse me. He's much more of a traditional quarterback than our Murray or Lamar. We'll see if they develop into Russ over time, in which case they'll have to be paid. So I'm not sure that low-salaried rookie quarterback works unless the guy is spectacular, if I make myself clear. I don't think it's a – I wouldn't hang my hat on that.
Yeah, you do. It's just – it's a funny thing just in the sense of, you know, the progression model doesn't seem to – you know, as much as we've talked through it on the show and just talked about it – and even as you mentioned earlier, when we were talking about Drew Lock, it's like you don't really know what you have till probably 3 years in some ways. I mean, you want to see the needle moving up, but it's still a progress and a process to know what you have in that position. It just seems antithetical that hasn't changed, but the emphasis on winning and winning quickly seems to be as important as it's ever been in the league. It's just, you wonder what the impetus is for that other than, you know, just the obvious of, you know, it's a win now business. It just seems sort of counterintuitive to the process of actually building a good team. Cause you wonder, like with Dallas, where it took a minute and Troy had that terrible year, you know, in the modern NFL, would Jimmy be one and done?
Well, I'm not sure he'd be one and done. Chuck Knoll would not have been. With 2-2-14 or 3-13, you know, two terrible years, because that's the Rooneys.
Yeah, right.
In a lot of other franchises, he would not have succeeded. And the answer to your question is, why is it a win now league? Because of talk radio, talk TV, internet, etc. That's why. And as some owners have mentioned, the fact that we charge prices now that are well above, relatively speaking, well above what were charged in the 60s and 70s. So fans are demanding return on their dollar.
So a couple things. One, as you mentioned, you know, the brilliant thing to me that the Ravens have done this is how they, Greg Roman, did exactly what you just mentioned, where he built an offense around what Lamar does best. I mean, they reshaped everything. And my only other comment is, who are you and where did Bill Polian go? This is Mr. Old School, the OG, and here I am saying something and you're telling me that's old school and you're in the new school. That has never happened in the history of this show. So, all right, I guess I got to be prepared for anything now.
Well, you got to be prepared for the fact that you look at the tape and you look at the numbers and you better adjust. Because if you don't, they'll leave you standing at the bus stop. And so, I've adjusted. I've recognized what the new game is. Okay, let's turn to Teddy Bridgewater. 98.7 QBR, 72.1 completion percentage, 13 TDs, 7 interceptions, 2-1 perfect, 7.7 YPA. No Christian McCaffrey for the last 3 weeks and now probably 2 weeks going forward. Not real mobile and wasn't real mobile when he came in. Can you win with Teddy Bridgewater? You bet. He's thrown for 2,552 yards. Is he going to take you to the promised land on a regular basis? Probably not, but you can win with Teddy Bridgewater. No two ways about it. Give him a better defense and give him Christian McCaffrey and it just a reliable tight end, not a great tight end. And you know, he's taking you to the playoffs. He's the most disrespected quarterback, even among football people, very honestly, that I've run across in recent years. But for my money, I'll put my money on him.
Hey, Bill, with Teddy, it seems like in this group, and obviously not jumping ahead, but he seems like one of the more likely candidates with some of those things happening to jump into the B group, right?
Yes. He'd probably be in a B group right now if he had McCaffrey and you know, with him. Because the B group is 100 or above. So, I mean, he's right there on the cusp of it. The next guy that we're going to talk about, the next two guys we're going to talk about are, you know, almost identical. Baker Mayfield, 94.5 QBR, 63.1 completion percentage, 15 TDs, 7 interceptions, 7.0. That's all acceptable. That's what you need. Jared Goff, 94.6, 68.5, 13-6, 7.6. So marginally better than Mayfield. But here's the difference. Jared Goff has thrown for 2,145 yards, and Baker Mayfield has thrown for 1,392 yards. And why is that? Because correctly, underlined correctly, because Mayfield is limited, more limited in my opinion than Goff, the Browns protect him with a great double-barreled running attack. He doesn't have to throw to win. And he's throwing, that's his low production among a winning quarterback as in terms of yardage as there is in the league. So it's a bit of an outlier. And by the way, he plays well against good teams and not so well against bad teams, but we'll break that out over 16 games. But the fact of the matter is that they protect him with a tremendous running game. And that's why they're winning. And that's why his numbers are what they are. If he had to throw a lot more, those numbers, I would suspect, would be markedly down.
So, Bill, let me ask you this. Obviously, he was an incredibly productive guy. And this is really going to be something where you're enlightening us all on a bigger issue. So he was an incredibly productive guy at the college level. He makes the jump to the pros, and as you say, there are deficits, there are deficiencies. What is it in either you can answer this generally or in his case that could where a guy could be so successful at a lower level, but what he doesn't have becomes so much more obvious when he gets to the ultimate level?
Well, the answer is obvious. At the lower level, and especially in the Big 12, you're playing against defenses, first of all, that don't care. The Big 12 doesn't emphasize defense. All you got to do is watch Big 12 games. It's a pinball game.
That's a known fact. Turn on the TV. I can tell you that.
That's exactly right, yeah. Your wife can tell you that. How come these guys don't tackle anybody? You know, right? So that's one thing. And second of all, when you reach this level, the defenders are all good. They're all great athletes. They're all better than what you played against in college. And they're better coached. And they're more bloodthirsty. And they care more. So it's a different level of competition. So, for example, when I looked at whether it's Mahomes or Baker Mayfield, you know, two ends of the spectrum in my mind, and you look at the numbers, you just say, it's the Big 12. So what? You know, let's analyze what the guy can do. What has he got going for him that's going to make him successful at this level? So, that's your answer. There's no relation to what he did in college as opposed to what he's done in the NFL. It's a different league.
I understand. I agree about the Big 12, but what I was trying to be a little bit more specific in his case. Aside from the fact that, yes, it's a lower quality of player you're playing with. That's true for everybody when they're in college versus the pros. Okay. All other Big 12 quarterbacks, all other, Big 10 quarterbacks, it's always going to be the case, but there's obviously something in him as say opposed to the guys who were going to have in the A group who made that jump that he was able to do certain things that he just can't do anymore. I mean, because he also has, great, he should have, equally, superior, offensive talent around him aside from the defensive talent. So why does Baker, really just sort of struggle, particularly relative to, beyond the transition from one level to another? Is it something in the way he throws? Is it his inability to read? That's what I'm getting at. What is the big thing that differentiates? I'm not talking about the talent, because to me, everybody faces that similarly in the jump from college to the pros.
Well, first of all, I don't think he sees the field quite well enough. Second of all, he flushes right far too often. He's far too anxious to get out of the pocket, because that's what he did at Oklahoma. And when he's out of the pocket, he will make throws that are, just inadvisable. You don't want to throw the ball back over the middle when you're out of the pocket. There are many times where he throws the ball to the opposition for no rhyme or reason because he's trying to make a play that isn't there. So, I mean, those are the two things that I would say jump at me when I watch the film. And he's not as efficient when he plays against really good defenses like the Pittsburgh Steelers, as one example. And the fact of the matter is, I would argue that these numbers, while they're good, wouldn't be as good except for the fact that they really run the ball, which gives him a decided advantage. He doesn't have to throw it all the time.
Well, also, how much of it could it just be in college, the Lincoln Riley effect? I mean, you've seen it with Baker. You've seen it with Kyler.
I don't buy that. It's a different game in the Big 12.
Oh, no. I'm just saying they looks better in college. But Lincoln Riley's offense is masking things that when you get to the pros, you go, this is – because, I mean, he wasn't an elite high school recruit, obviously, coming out. Obviously, Coach Riley runs a very successful offensive system in college. You just wonder if now you see him struggle, if Kyler were to struggle. Some of that you could just chalk up to the fact that he's just playing in an offense that produces, amazing college statistics but might not be ready for the NFL.
Well, I think, yeah.
Or might not produce players that are ready for the NFL.
I don't know that it has anything to do with the coach. I think it has to do with the fact that, the jump up is a huge jump. I've said this 100 times. I may not have said it on this show, but I've said it 100 times in any number of areas. NBA draft is taking place this week. And if you asked any NBA fan, first of all, do you know any of the guys in the draft? The answer would be 90% of the people would say no. After the first 3 guys, I don't know of anybody. Most, half of them are from overseas. And second of all, why should I care, really? The huge jump is such a jump. The NBA is so much harder than college basketball. It's not even close. It's no big deal. Right? Except for the most hardcore fans, that's where people are on the NBA draft. They're much more interested in NBA free agency than they are the NBA draft. But the college football jump in the minds of fans, because Rick just asked the question, is, oh, well, gee, Baker Mayfield or Joe Blow was so successful at the college level. He was tremendous every week. I saw a man, Lincoln Riley's offense. Why doesn't he do better in the NFL? Because the jump is bigger than it is to the NBA, from college basketball to the NBA. The jump is bigger. Why? Because it's a much more physical game. But fans don't perceive that. And the media doesn't perceive it. It's perception versus reality.
Right. You'll never see a guy coming out of high school and going straight to the NFL the way you can in basketball. I mean, just, you know, it's, as you said in the past, even somebody, a college senior overall, it's men against boys.
Yeah, that's exactly correct. We talked about Jared Goff, you know, much more efficient, although the numbers are the same. And, you know, Jared is a very solid quarterback. Can he get up over 100? I think so. I think the arrow's still up there and there's room to grow. So, and he too now is playing with a really good defense. So, his team has a chance to go a long way, and we'll see as the season goes along how he progresses. So, that's group C. And there are some guys in that group, like Mayfield and like Goff, who have a chance to grow and move up. There are some like Teddy that are right on the cusp. And then we'll talk about the last member of that group, is Kirk Cousins. And, his QBR is 97.7. This is exclusive. No, that's inclusive of, no, it's exclusive of Monday night. Excuse me. At 65.6 completion percent. No, let me correct myself. This includes Monday night. 15 TDs, 10 interceptions, 8.9 yards, per attempt. And the interceptions have been cut down recently. But 15-10 isn't good enough. Interceptions have been his problem throughout his career. They, too, are protecting him by running the football. He's thrown for 1,855 yards, but they are basically a running football team. And since they've gone exclusively to the run game as their number one weapon, they've gotten better, and he's gotten better. Having said that, the only flaw is the interceptions. Everything else is super positive. The fact that he get paid a whole lot of money is a function of the marketplace and the marketplace only, and the timing when he came to the marketplace. That's not to be held against him, and I don't even factor it in to my considerations. He's everything you want in a quarterback except for the interceptions. And maybe with this new focus going forward and the ability to make big plays off the play action game and defenses having to honor that run, he'll finally have a good long run in the playoffs. I hope so. I'm rooting for him. But the bottom line is the 10 interceptions and the ratio doesn't cut it in terms of predictability for winning and playoffs in the NFL. So there we are.
Hey, one thing with Kirk, I mean, because we sort of had a trend buck on Monday night, you know, with him winning in primetime. Kirk has a very odd sort of statistical anomaly almost, where he's 5-11 in primetime games. And I mean, he's also 8-31 against winning teams. But the primetime thing is interesting in that, you know, granted, when he was here in Washington, I mean, Washington seems to have, we haven't won on Monday night in 20 years. But how much of a factor of that is the player? Do you read into anything like that when you see something statistically where, you know, a particular player hasn't won a ton in primetime? Or is that just something that's a total fan kind of outlier thing?
I would want to go back and look at all the film to see if there's any truth to it, but my experience tells me there's none. It's just a story. And, you know, we don't live in the world of stories. Now, if I got a statistic that showed that he threw twice as many interceptions on Monday night or in prime time as he threw in other games, that might tell you something. I didn't dive into it that deeply. So you'd want to do a lot more research on it. But on the surface, I wouldn't even pay any attention to it.
Yeah, because my vibe with him has always been that he sort of pressed. That, like, with Kirk, the interceptions, maybe not winning in big games, is that he, in certain moments, he just really presses.
Well, I'm not sure I have an answer for that. I don't refute it, but I don't accept it without analysis. Tell me what games you want me to look at. Tell me when you thought he pressed. And then I'll look at the games and I'll tell you whether I agree or disagree. This is something I used to tell the scouts all the time.
Yeah.
Don't tell me I like this guy. Tell me why you like him.
Week 5, 2017 season, Atlanta game, going into overtime. There's a throw that I'm positive he pressed on. I got a couple. We'll do this offline because I got a bunch of my sort of Kirk Cousins Redskin Rolodex is pretty deep.
Well, get me the film reel. Put a reel together, and I'll look at it.
He'll do it.
This might be my project this week. This is my Thanksgiving fun.
So what about, contrary to that, the statistic, and I assume the statistics in terms of the numbers were correct, that they put up there that showed that his productivity in the fourth quarter when it's crunch time was enormously better than it was in the first three quarters over the course of his career. So that's a pretty broad sample. Bill, what do you think about that? And Scott, I don't see how you can say that when a guy's in the clutch, if he gets better in the fourth quarter, I don't see how he can be choking.
How do you know it's the clutch? He may be in a situation.
Yeah, they're playing from behind.
They're playing from behind, and he's throwing every down.
Well, that's true.
That stat is completely misleading, and I've had this argument with all of my friends.
I know, but what I'm saying is, I'm not just saying it's the clutch in the sense that they are behind and he has to bring them back.
So what?
Well,
he doesn't bring them back.
He's playing against prevent defenses, number one. He's playing against looser defenses, number one. And number two, how many did he bring him back? You know, fourth quarter passing means nothing absent the other context.
So that would just the network to hype the story, I guess, brought that up, and that same, because it was a drastic differential, that same relative differential should be true for all quarterbacks, right? I mean, because you're playing against looser defenses if you're ahead if you're way behind.
No, because you're when you're ahead, you might be in 4 minute mode.
Right.
How many possessions did you have in the fourth quarter?
Yeah.
How many plays did you have?
I meant to say behind. But so, okay. So I guess if those situations are somewhat randomly distributed, I know he's played for bad teams, but, okay. And so if it's attributable to all that, and Scott, I know you don't, you know, where you're coming from on this.
Cause I've looked at that stat all week. That's a TV stat, not to start to sound like Bill and not that we're doing some mind control cult here, but I've heard it from Bill enough that it's story creation, right? So it's an outlier statistic that presupposes something that's not real because he's always been coming from behind in the fourth quarter. At least his entire career here, he was coming from behind in the fourth quarter. Defenses were playing softer and he was stat stuffing.
So that's what I was asking. But the statistic itself was accurate. So that's what I was asking.
Yeah, the statistic's accurate, but I think it's a misleading statistic.
Yeah, okay. That was the purpose of the question. I'm not contending that he is. That's what I was asking.
Numbers lie and people use numbers to lie.
Right. Well, lies, damn lies, and statistics.
One time on NFL Live, we were joking around and having one of these discussions. I don't know whether it was actually on the air or at a production meeting. And I took a 3x5 card or 5x8 card, and I wrote two words on it, and I held it up. And the two words were, so what? Who cares that he's great in the fourth quarter? There's so much context that has to be factored in there, and so much analysis that is necessary to derive some meaningful opinion from that. That it's so what? I mean, what does it mean? Nothing.
Oh, I'm with you. I just thought it was, if Scott was going to ask a fan question, it was time to counter him with a fan question. And you know, I'll yield on this one because Scott has obviously studied this for the entire week.
Oh, I've looked at this nonstop. Plus, I'm already sort of mentally putting my cut-up tape together. I'm thinking about the Giant game in 2017, probably his last throw at FedEx Field as a member of the Washington football team. That was a press. I'm going to cut it up for you this week, Bill.
Okay.
I'll be happy to look at it.
Make sure it's a decent sample size, Scott.
I'm gonna hem peck it. I'm a cherry pick.
All right.
No, you can't. No, you can't cherry pick.
I'm
it's
not.
Gotta be a decent enough sample size.
Yeah.
Yes.
Show the touchdown passes too.
I will. He had a great game that year against Green Bay. All right. Well, that puts a cap on Group C. So if you haven't heard your quarterbacks in D or C, have faith. They're in B or A, which we will get into next week. But without much further ado, we are back to our normal routine of hitting the audible with fan questions. And the first one this week, Bill, comes from a beleaguered Jets fan who I think there's like some subtext context clues to this question. And this is also sort of more of a statement than a question, but the question reads, the Jets hired a head coach first and then added a GM in their last cycle. Don't you think the opposite should be done in the next cycle, or will they let this GM proceed in another cycle?
Well, my assumption is that Joe Douglas is going to stay, and that, you know, I don't have any pipeline to the Johnson family. Woody, as we know, is in England, and Christopher is running the Jets, and I haven't spoken to either man in a long time. So this is purely speculation on my part. But my presumption is that Joe Douglas is going to stay, and then he will sit down with both Johnsons at the end of the season and discuss what he thinks ought to be done and what road the team should take, and the coaches – future will be discussed in the normal course of events. That's what usually happens in the NFL. The general manager and ownership sits down and discusses the team and all the player personnel and all the coaching personnel and all the support personnel, and they determine what the future course of action is going to be. That's business as usual in the NFL. The only exception to that is New England, for example, where Bill Belichick is both the head coach and general manager. Well, the guy that wears two hats has that discussion with the Krafts. In most other places, it's the general manager. In some cases, it would be the general manager and the head coach together. But that's, again, that situation is relatively, I wouldn't say rare, but it's not usual. So, you know, that's the way it's done, and that's the way I expect it will happen.
Very cool. All right, Rick, hit us up.
So, Bill, here's the last question. How in the hell did the Bills let Hopkins catch that ball at the end of the game? I mean, in those situations, pass interference is never called. You're up in the air. All you have to do is, like, you're going after a guy for a bet. You know, you push him this small of his back, or you rake down his arms. How do you do that? I mean, don't they tell guys to do this stuff? I mean, how can a guy who makes it, two guys who make it to the NFL not do such a basic thing and let a game they've won be taken right out of their hands?
Well, I'll give you both an accurate and descriptive answer. First of all, Leslie Frazier was on our staff in Indianapolis for a long period of time. I have the highest regard for him. He's an outstanding defensive coordinator. He's the Bills defensive coordinator. Sean McDermott, in his press conference, in so many words, said, you know, maybe we should have played it differently. I think that's Sean's way of saying perhaps we didn't handle it as well as we should have conceptually. Tony Dungy went on television Monday night and Sunday night and taught the general public exactly what he taught everyone on our staff. First of all, in that situation, you impede the release of the two likeliest receivers, which are Fitzgerald and the other guy. So you press them on the line of scrimmage. You try not to commit a foul, but you reroute them. That's what it's called. And you put them in a situation where you disrupt the timing of the route to begin with. Secondly, in Kyler Murray's case, you do not ever let him outside the pocket. You build a wall that keeps him in the pocket. Kyler Murray is an outstanding player. He's magic with the ball in his hands. He's a better thrower than any young quarterback that's come in the league since Mahomes, except when he's in the pocket. Then he's 5'10". And then he has difficulty seeing down the field. He has difficulty finding lanes. And he's high with a lot of balls and inaccurate with certain balls. So you keep him in the pocket. That requires the defensive line to do something that no defensive lineman wants to do, has ever been taught to do, except perhaps in New England, and and no defensive line coach ever wants to do. And that is to not sack the quarterback. You're not trying to sack him. And as Rex Ryan pointed out on television on numerous occasions, you rush five. It's called a cover front. You cover every offensive lineman. You rush right down the middle of the offensive lineman. If you are a defensive end, you keep your outside arm free. You never go by the level of the quarterback. Wherever his level is, you never pass it. You never try to sack him. You try to keep penning him into that pocket. Keep him in the pocket. Keep squeezing it. Keep squeezing it. And when he tries to escape, you maintain your leverage. And now instead of having linebackers aligned at about 15 yards where he's not going to throw the ball, you know it's going to the end zone with however much time was left on the clock, 9 or 7 seconds. Those linebackers act as spies. So if you flush him up the middle, they're there to tackle him. They're there to keep him in the pocket. Now, I don't know if the linebackers were told to do that or not. It didn't look like they were, but it's hard to know how players are going to react. So that was sin number one, letting him out of the pocket. Because when he's out of the pocket, he's as dangerous as Mahomes. In fact, more dangerous because he's more dangerous with his feet. So you never let him out of the pocket at any time during the game. Is he going to get out sometimes? Yes. But right. You strive to keep him in the pocket, not to sack him. And the defensive end lost leverage. And the defensive end came at too sharp an angle. He got beyond him, which you never should do. And the defensive end did not come down the middle of the blocker, forcing the blocker into him, creating a second level for him to throw over. He used the wrong technique. Secondly, as Tony pointed out, they didn't reroute the receivers. And then thirdly, when the ball is up there, I said it in front of my television set. I'm sure everyone that ever played for us on defense in Indianapolis said it when they were watching the game. The words that Tony would repeat over and over and over again when we practiced that, knock it down. Don't try to catch it. Knock it down. Spike it. Knock it into the ground. Because when you knock it down, you can't get a rebound. You can't get a bounce off. Knock it down. So nobody who was coming in from behind, and I don't know whether it was Poyer or who it was. I can't remember who the player was. They attempted to get up and get the ball. Knock it down. And in doing so, you'll knock the receiver's arms akimbo. Mm-hmm. And the officials never called that. So
never.
The cardinal sin was letting Murray out of the pocket. The second sin was not knocking the ball down.
So if you've learned nothing else today, kids, knock the ball down. I was thinking what was yelled at our house, which was bite or punch. Could not believe it. Sitting next to my father-in-law, we're screaming, just punch him. Just at that point, get a PI. Do anything, but don't let that happen.
When's the last time you've seen DPI called in that situation?
Exactly. There's actually truth in that. Plus, there's ways to do it where they can't possibly. You got the guy sandwiched in between two players. How are they going to see if you push him in the small of his back so you tilt him backwards and he can't catch the ball? How's anybody? There's no referee you can see that, and they'll never call it on that kind of a play anyway. Yeah, absolutely. Pass interfere.
Any number of things. Yeah. Well,
the normal human reaction is to want to go up there and rebound the ball. That's the normal human reaction. DBs are taught to high point the ball. They're taught to go up with their hands. Constantly told because you want turnovers, catch it in your hands, high point the ball. But that's the exception, and you have to practice that, and you have to drill it, and they have to know in that situation, knock it down, spike the ball.
Right. You know, you see it too, Bill, in plays at near the end of the game when the offense is on fourth down. They're throwing it deep. All the guys to do is knock it down, and he catches it and puts his own team at the negative nine instead of going back to the line of scrimmage, at the negative, 40. So, I mean, I guess that is just instinctual, but, to me, they're not thinking when they do that stuff.
No, that's right. They're not thinking, and that's, smart football is what wins.
But it was a fun game to watch, man. That was a fun TV property.
Oh, yeah. Surely was.
Except if you're in Buffalo.
Absolutely.
But hey, you learned a lot about Josh Allen on the drive before it. I mean, that was as good as it gets. I mean, that was a hell of a lot of fun to watch.
Yeah, he's got a lot of grit about him.
And we'll be talking about him.
The thing about Buffalo is that is a conference, a non-conference loss. So that's not as hurtful as a conference or division loss would be.
Do you worry that loss stings going into this week? I mean, is that something that Coach McDermott needs to kind of address in some way with the team, early in the week? Or is that something where everybody's professionals, you just put that one behind you? Because, I mean, that truly, you could see how a loss like that, especially after Allen drives him down the field, they get the touchdown, that could be deflating and you could have a little bit of a hangover.
Well, this is where head coaches really count in the NFL. First of all, we have lots of young players on teams in the NFL, very much more so than we used to have. Since the latest, the 11 collective bargaining agreement, virtually 60% of your team, sometimes more, is made up of players who are not veteran players, don't even qualify for a pension. Or have not yet qualified for a pension. So they're not used to this. They have to learn how to win. And so I know, because I know Sean McDermott and I know what kind of a coach he is, and I know Leslie Frazier and I know what kind of coach he is, both of them are going to talk about how to handle this situation. That's why you have a Monday walkthrough where you go over the mistakes that you made the previous day. You send everybody home, and then you come back on Wednesday, as Tony often said, and echoing Marv Levy and Chuck Knoll and Bill Walsh and whomever else, whatever other Hall of Famer you want to talk about, There is a 24-hour period where we get mad, where we mourn, where we talk about mistakes, and then throw it in the garbage can, and we're on to the next opponent. That's what professionalism is all about. You cannot let it linger. And the most famous example of that was Bill Belichick, who was speaking to his team and not to the media when he famously had a press conference after Cincinnati. Well, it wasn't Cincinnati. I can't recall who the opponent was, but they throttled him pretty good in Foxborough. They had one of those games where, you know, you lay.
I think that was the Chiefs, I think, wasn't it? Wasn't
might have been the Chiefs. Chief yeah, that's correct.
Yeah.
And so he came into the press conference and the questions were flying fast and furious. Why didn't you convert on third down? Why did you do this? And he kept saying, on to Cincinnati, on to Cincinnati, on to Cincinnati.
Yep.
He was talking to his team, not the media. And that's what you have to do as a coach. That's what you have to do. You have to teach them to put the last game in the past, put the last play in the past, and move on to the next one. And the best coaches do that, and they drown out the noise. And if you see a team bounce back, which I'm certain the Bills will, then you know that the coach is getting through. And you know that he's preaching the right message. When you see teams wallow around and don't have the capacity to overcome mistakes and suffer difficult losses and don't bounce back, then you know that they're not getting the message. The message isn't getting through. Sometimes they don't have the capacity to absorb it. Good teams are professional, put it in the back burner and move on. Put it in the trash can and move on. And we used to coach our guys. Tony was the number one teacher, obviously, but everybody else in the organization echoed it. They're saying, look, don't ask us about the last game. We talked about that in the locker room. That's over with. We're on to Baltimore, or we're on to New England, mm-hmm. or whomever. Mm-hmm. We're not even going to talk about that.
All right.
Well, hey, it's a perfect segue. We're on to the A's and the B's next week, guys. So with that, if you have any questions or anything you want us to hit in the audible, please feel free to hit us up on Twitter at IFBillPolian. We will be sure to include it in the show. And remember, in a few weeks, we're going to do a Twitter version of Ask Bill Anything, where we do an entire audible episode. So keep them pouring in. We're excited to do it. And we are on to the A's and the B's. Thank you, guys.
All right, and I just want to say to you out there, if you guys want to cut up your own reel and send it to Scott, go ahead and do that.
Have at it, man. Hey, there's a great YouTube site that does every throw, and you can literally watch every quarterback. I did with Zach Wilson this week, where you watch cut up of everybody. We'll throw it out on Twitter for everybody.
There you go.
Thank you, everybody, and please mask up and stay safe.
Absolutely.
Very true. Thank you, guys.